Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott in for Marty Moscowane. Over the next few weeks, we will continue to be bombarded with political messages coming at us from every which direction. They will pop up online, follow us on Facebook, greet us on Twitter, and urge us to vote and contribute in our personal email inboxes. Of course, there will also be voicemails and calls at home and actual people knocking on your door. President Obama even joked about this overstimulation of political messaging in his acceptance speech at the DNC, saying that the truth gets buried under an avalanche of money and advertising, and if you're sick of hearing me approve this message, believe me, so am I. But behind all of this is a carefully orchestrated strategy, relying on ever-increasing amounts of data and research tools. That's what, according to journalist and author Sasha Eisenberg. He's joining us in the studio. You might actually remember him from the years he spent as a reporter for Philadelphia Magazine. And his new book is The Victory Lab. Sasha, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Sasha, you begin this book in Colorado during the 2010 elections, where 1 million Democratic voters get personal letters shortly before the election. What was in those letters?
The letters were sort of amazing for how vague they were, right? It was this moment in the fall of 2010 where we had this sort of epic battle between the Tea Party and the Obama coalition. And these letters came through and they made no reference to it. It said, dear voter, I want to thank you for having taken the time to participate in the 2008 elections. As you may know, there's another election coming up here in Colorado in November, and I hope I will be able to thank you again after the election for having participated.
Signed who?
Signed by a group that nobody had ever heard of.
And then what?
The people who got it, based on all the experimental research we have, probably voted at a higher rate than people who didn't. There's been this new method of measuring effectiveness in campaigns, which is people using randomized control trials, which are basically drug trials for politics, pharmaceutical trials, except instead of giving some people a drug and some people a placebo, you randomly assign those phone calls or web ads or pieces of direct mail, and then you measure political behaviors afterwards. Did people vote at a higher rate if they received a certain message? Did they change their opinion? And there's been this huge body of work that shows that there's what behavioral psychologists call social pressure. People want to live up to the sort of image they've created for themselves as a good citizen. They want to live up to what they think their neighbors are doing. And this idea of telling people very subtly that they're being observed, that their behaviors, voting or not voting, are kind of being monitored is something that's sort of migrate into politics as a tool for motivating people.
So, first of all, who sent those letters? Who was behind it? And obviously the effort here is not to change anybody's mind, but to actually target people to come out to vote. So they must have pre-selected who they wanted to vote on some level.
Exactly. This is a group called the Voter Participation Center. It used to be called Women's Voices, Women's Vote, that was created in the wake of the 2000 election, initially to mobilize unmarried women who tend to vote, started voting Democratic at a much higher rate than married women. Increasingly, this group, and their change of name reflects this, has started to include what they call the Rising American Electorate, which is minorities, young people, still unmarried women. And their goal, as you say, is just to mobilize. They do registration, they do mobilization. They don't do persuasion, which is how campaigns refer to changing people's minds or getting undecideds to come over to their side. And I think that it's telling that all this has happened in the wake of 2000, which is sort of the first election when we realized how polarized this country really is. And the number of voters who are really sort of susceptible to being moved in their opinions from one side to the other is actually very small. And we see this now. We look at the polls, these 48, 46, 49, 47. That means that 7% of people are telling a pollster they're undecided. And maybe there are another, 3-5% soft Obama supporters who could conceivably be convinced to defect or soft Romney supporters the other way. But ultimately, that means that, maybe 15% of voters' sort of opinions are in play. 85% of the voters' behaviors are in play. And so increasingly campaigns are focusing resources in intelligent ways on mobilizing people who already support them but need an extra nudge or a reminder or in some cases this sort of, pretty subtle peer pressure to come out to vote.
But what meets the eye, at least to me as a consumer of media, is still that persuasion, like, hey, vote for me, vote for me. But behind the scenes, it's more about get out and vote? We know that you like us?
Yeah, well, so there's sort of two levels here. I mean, campaigns talk of two different types of communicating. There's media, which tends to be TV, radio, highly untargeted, right? If you buy an ad, it shows up across the Philadelphia media market, across the state lines, across the demographic boundaries. You don't know who saw it. And then there's what they call voter contact, which is individually targeted communications. Historically, this has been phones, direct mail, people knocking on your doors. They know who you are. They're talking to you because you fit into a category of people that they want to talk to. And usually, they're getting information back.
How do they know who I am? How did they pick the people who got the letters that said, hey, you voted last time and we want you to vote again?
So in this case, these are people who are registered to vote. But and in this particular instance, there were people who registered to vote. They'd voted in 2008. I think all of them were first-time voters in 2008 and hadn't voted in other elections since then. And this is, in strategic terms for 2012, this is arguably the most important category of voters for a mobilization perspective. People who came out in the, sort of Obama wave, who are not habitual voters, who have not sort of conditioned the behavior of voting, but did in 2008. And so much of the sort of ground level activity we see from the Obama campaign and their allies on the Democratic side is based on trying to re-motivate these people to vote again this year.
And your voting records are public, so don't be surprised when you get that kind of letter in the mail, right?
Right. So when you register to vote, you're giving them your name, your address, gender, date of birth. So there's basic sort of demographic profile that's there. And then every election you vote in is recorded. And we could walk over to the Board of Elections at City Hall right now and figure out if you voted in the last primary or you voted going back many years. And this has always been information that campaigns have used for the longest time. It's been much easier to computerize it and to sort of merge databases in the last 10, 15 years. But this has always been how they make the calculations of trying to do sort of triage, separating people who are definitely going to vote without our help, people who are never going to vote, we're not going to waste resources, and then get out the vote is about mobilizing people who sort of need that extra push or that reminder.
But we don't know how somebody voted, right?
And so obviously the secret ballot is still in place. Campaigns, though, believe that they can predict how you will vote, but there's no public record.
Because you're registered. Right. All right. We're talking with Sasha Eisenberg. He has written a new book. It's called The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. And to take us back quickly to Colorado. So here, 1 million people received those letters urging them to get out the vote. And then basically, what was the outcome? It did increase participation.
We believe it did. And so there's a sort of long arc that led to those letters in Colorado. So I'll take you back to Michigan in 2006, where this first experiment was run, sort of testing social pressure in politics. This was this direct mail vendor, this pretty idiosyncratic guy named Mark Grebner, who's based in East Lansing, who ended up collaborating with a bunch of political scientists to run this experiment for him. And he had long had this idea that you could shame people into voting if they
shame.
Well, because as you sort of noted, Mike, and I think a lot of people don't realize how public knowledge of whether or not you turn out to vote is. People assume just because their ballot is secret that sort of everything about their political behavior is secret. And his idea, which they sent out in a gubernatorial primary in Michigan in 2010, they randomly assigned letters, and one of them sent voters a letter that says, "Dear Mike, as you may know, your history as a voter is a publicly available document with the County Board of Elections. Here is your vote history." And I think that the last 6 or 8 elections, you didn't vote in the school board election, you did vote in the primary for governor, you did vote in this. And here are your neighbors' vote histories. And it picked out people on the same block and it had their last 6 or 8 elections, whether or not they participated. Then said, as you may know, there's another election coming up. Afterwards, we'll send everybody an updated set. And this had a greater impact on mobilizing people to vote than anything that's ever been measured before. Just astronomical. Like turnout went up 8% in the group that received this over the control group. The guy who sent it got death threats. People accused him of basically blackmailing them into voting. And so,
but still they voted?
They still voted. And that was the sort of thing that was remarkable, was the utility of this as a sort of behavioral motivator was clear, but campaigns and parties did not want to put their name as the return address on letters that voters would sort of accused of being bullying or blackmail.
And I want to ask you, my neighbor, I told her last night that I was going to talk to you today, and she said, you know what, I just got this email from the Obama campaign. It said, pledge to vote. Right. So she said, okay, I pledge to vote, click. And then she immediately gets an email back, and it says, well, guess what? You're not registered to vote. And she thought, what? And then she checked her registration, and she is indeed registered to vote. So it's very personal at this point.
Yes. And so I don't know about her particular registration. It may have been that the name match or,
we'll
or,
find
or
out
the address.
We'll find out now.
But the pledging is another thing people have done years of experiments on. It comes out of other behavioral psychology research. And people have done experiments where they get people to sign. Initially, it was in the pre-email days, people do with postcards where they would get voters to physically sign a postcard saying, I pledge to vote. And then groups would send back the card days before the election as a reminder saying, hey, you promised. It's coming up. And there's sort of behavioral science theories as to why people, if they're reminded of their pledges, actually are more likely to follow through on their actions. And it's one of these many insights from psychology that has been translated into politics in the last few years, and people are using the same types of randomized control trials that they would use in psychology experiments to show that they work in the political world.
And when did psychologists, I don't want to go through the whole history,
sure,
but when did psychologists become so important in figuring out how to get people to vote and how to get them out there?
Really in the last 5 years or so. You know, I think that it's always been pretty hard to understand why people vote. Political scientists have tried to explain in economic terms, and frankly makes no sense. The costs of voting are pretty high. You go to a lot of trouble, learn about the candidates, show up, wait in line, and the benefits are really low. This very small possibility that your vote will make a difference and that the difference will matter to you. And so psychologists have been increasingly finding that the benefits have to do more with the social interactions around voting, how people see themselves, how they want to be seen by their neighbors, the sort of social dynamics that not just to take place at the moment you vote, but beforehand and afterwards, and how you feel about yourself at those times.
But isn't there the possibility that, you know, you could spend all this effort getting somebody to the poll and then they vote for the other guy?
Yes. And so to go back, you know, so campaigns are predicting how likely you are to vote for them. And so they're not going to mobilize somebody they think has a 50% chance of voting for them. But if you're a 75% chance of voting for them, as probably most of the people in this Colorado test where they sent out a million letters, I bet that they had an average expectation that 75% of them would support it. At some point, you drive up the margins. It becomes like fast food. If you can get a million people to turn out, even if only 3 out of 4 of them support you, you're still generating votes.
We're talking with Sasha Eisenberg. His new book is The Victory Lap, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. He also has a blog on Slate.com that you can follow. And we want people to call in. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499, 1-888-477-9499. Coming up, Sasha, I want to talk a bit about the micro-targeting that is going on with fundraising and with emails that people are getting. So maybe you've been hearing from candidates in very personal ways and want to talk about it. Again, that number is 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back here on Radio Times with Sasha Eisenberg.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, chestercountyhospital.org.
Where you go to know what's happening in the arts. From paintings to plays to pastries, Friday Arts celebrates local cultural expression, October 5th. Where you go to know tomorrow's greats today. Starting October 14th, On Stage at Curtis showcases powerful performers and captivating concerts. Where you go to know what inspires talented musicians. On Canvas features legends and up-and-comers, on stage and behind the curtain, starting October 18th. The new fall season on WHYY-TV, where you go to know.
This week in This American Life, Joe had all kinds of schemes to make money in the most unlikely of places, and then he came up with one that just seemed too good to be true. But there was one problem. To collect the money, he'd have to be dead.
All we need to do is replace the necessity of the investor having to die with someone else.
Which he did this week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY. The Mann Center and AEG Live support WHYY. Sunday, September 16th, Bon Iver live in concert at the Mann, and October 3rd, it's Animal Collective. Tickets for Bon Iver and Animal Collective live at the Mann at Ticketmaster.com or ManCenter.org.
We're talking with journalist and author Sasha Eisenberg about his new book, The Victory Lab, The Secret Signs of Winning Campaigns, here on Radio Times, and our phone lines are filling up, and we're going to get to the phones in a minute. But Sasha, I think we forgot to tell people what happened in Colorado. So there was this massive effort to get the vote out, and then by a small margin...
The Democrat Michael Bennett won the race, and it was like 25,000 votes in the end. You know, and I think one of the things that's really important, and why a lot of this stuff has happened after 2000 is... You know, not just the polarization, we had a really close election. And so a lot of these improvements, these experiments are about getting 2%, 3% better at mobilizing people or using data to find efficiencies that get you a few percentage better at targeting some of these contacts. And, you know, we live in a world post-Florida where, you know, in before 2000, people might have laughed at the idea of I'm going to invest some money in getting 2% more of the vote. After 2000, everybody was ready to do anything they could that seems smart to get there.
Because that could be the game changer. And you say in the book that helping Americans choose their leaders has grown into a $6 billion a year industry.
And, you know, and that went to press months ago before when I think I was underestimating how much the super PACs would take in. And it wouldn't surprise me if that ends up being a total of something like $8 billion this cycle at all levels.
Okay, so what are we spending that money on? And maybe we can talk about how much is spent on what we might call traditional messaging, the campaign ads and so on, and how much is spent on this effort to get certain groups to the polls and to the voting booths.
I mean, still overwhelmingly, TV is the biggest line item in major campaign budgets. And there have been improvements in targeting television, but it still remains, you know, compared to the stuff you can do either in web ads or at the door, relatively imprecise. The advantages of television are obviously that you can sort of show a candidate in their entirety. You can tell a story in a way you can in a piece of direct mail. And so, you know, the other stuff remains, you know, entirely secondary. Internet spending is growing rapidly as a percentage of campaign budgets. And a lot of that is because now you can basically do TV quality video online. So you're getting most of the advantages, the creative advantages of television ads, but some of the targeting advantages that have come with direct mail in the past.
And how much do these strategists make? And how many strategists and researchers does any one of these candidates, I'm not just talking presidential candidates, have at their beck and call?
Yeah, I mean, most campaigns have a sort of circle of consultants, and they each have a specialty. You know, there's a media person who does the TV ads, there's a direct mail person who does the mail, there's somebody who does the phones. There are pollsters, obviously, and then there are people on staff. You know, it's a real industry, and... you know, one of the things that's interesting is how a lot of the people I'm writing about in the book are sort of outsiders to the traditional consulting world. People come from academia and have used tools that they were using for scholarly research to sort of measure things in politics. You know, one of the sort of amazing things I write about the Obama campaign in 2008, where they were pulling in people who had never worked in politics before but had really interesting technical backgrounds. There are two separate guys who sort of volunteering for the campaign who had done econometrics academic work. They basically built economic forecasting models, and they come into a campaign and they see all this data about voters, and they start doing basically the same thing, which is coming up with predictive models, except instead of trying to decide what's going to happen to the economy, they're trying to figure out what voters are going to do when they get to the polls.
And are these guys loyal to one political direction or another, or are they loyal or addicted to what they can find out?
The academics are... sort of varied. Most people are on a side, and it's hard to get trust from candidates or parties or organizations if you're sort of a mercenary, because, you know, any insights or trade secrets tend to be guarded. I do have one chapter about Rick Perry's 2006 campaign, where these four academics were brought in that Perry's advisor Dave Carney called the eggheads, and were invited to run experiments on every aspect of Perry's campaign that they could measure. And two of the guys were from Yale. They had worked with mostly liberal groups like Acorn doing experiments previously. They claimed that their research was nonpartisan. They wanted to publish anything they could find. They said, you know, we're not on the Democratic team, Republican team, we're on team science. But they still brought in two Republican political scientist who'd worked with the Bush campaign because they didn't think they would be trusted as Ivy League guys going down to Texas working with all these Republican consultants on a campaign.
And I want to get to Rick Perry's methods in a moment, but do these people carefully guard what they find? Does it get out there? Do they all copy each other?
Yes, and so the those letters in Colorado have sort of that tool, that technique has spread pretty widely, and people, various forms of the social pressure thing are now being used all over the country by people in both parties. You know, the sort of influx of academics into politics doing this sort of advanced research in the last decade has meant that you do have people with sort of different incentives. Some of them who are happy to do private research for groups or campaigns or candidates that they believe in. And are sometimes getting paid for it, and people who want to publish because they have an academic interest in publishing. And so the experiment that I talked about in Michigan, this huge breakthrough social pressure experiment where they threatened people to the sort of shaming, was published in the American Political Science Review 2 years afterwards, and it was it was probably the ballsiest thing that the American Political Science Review has ever published, and it meant that was no secret for terribly long.
Now let's talk about your work on Rick Perry and his eggheads, and it was actually that came out as an ebook in 2011. So what did Rick Perry and his campaign do that was so different?
So Perry has been running for office in Texas for since the mid '80s, and he's pretty good at raising money, but like a lot of politicians, he doesn't particularly enjoy being on the phone asking people for money. And I think he's always been, in a sort of like homespun way, skeptical of the campaign consultants who are always pitching him things that force him to raise more money. And his top political advisor, this guy Dave Carney, who's this sort of massive, profane guy from New Hampshire who worked in the first Bush administration's political director and has been sort of out on his own as a sort of mercenary, has come to have a lot of disdain for other consultants. And so he's a general consultant. He's basically the version of the contractor at the construction site who brings in the carpenter and the stonemason or whatever. And he thought that all of them were basically bilking him and his clients, and that there was sort of they were never held accountable if they lost. And so when he heard that there were these academics who were running these, randomized experiments that allowed them to empirically measure what works and what doesn't in politics, he thought, wow, I can finally basically audit the people that I hired to work for me. And he was expecting to spend something like $40 million on Perry's 2006 gubernatorial race. And he thought, if I can bring in these guys and we can measure and we can just get a few percent better, if we can save a few million dollars by cutting things out that don't work, redirecting resources where they do work, that's worthwhile. And so he brought in what are ultimately these four eggheads, as he called them, and he said, anything in this campaign that we're spending money on that you can come up with a way to measure through experiments, go ahead. And the most audacious thing they did was, for several days, they randomized Perry's travel around Texas. And for 3 weeks, they randomized his television and radio buys across the 18 of Texas's media markets. And they were polling at a massive volume every day. And so what they were able to do was to isolate the impact of Rick Perry physically campaigning in a given city on a given day and his ads being present in a market. And it was something that nobody had ever been able to measure before,
Or ever tried,
because the tools are really crude. There's so many things. There's so much noise going on in a campaign every day. There are a million things going on, and so Mitt Romney was in Pittsburgh last week. If his poll numbers move up or down, does that have anything to do with Rick Perry being in Pittsburgh? Not until you do experiments like this can you actually isolate the cause and the effect.
So it reminds me of evidence-based medicine to some degree.
Yeah, no, and this was something that, starting basically in the 40s and 50s, medicine caught on to the value of experiments. Political science has been much later to it, basically a half century later, but we're seeing some version of the same revolution that's taken place in other fields now happening in campaigns.
So some analysts have called this the information's arms race, which seems appropriate. But where is all this data coming from, and is everybody just trying to do more and more of this kind of research?
Yeah, so the big shift has been individual-level data. So we've always known what's on your voter registration record. We've always had some information from the census about the neighborhood in which you live that gives me some ability to understand your community, make some guesses about your socioeconomic status, education levels, race, ethnicity. And then there's all the information that's come from other political interactions that you've had over the years, which now are very easy to keep in a database. Things that might have once been written down on a clipboard when a canvasser came to your door 15 years ago to ask you what you thought about, you know, Al Gore, now resides as a data point somewhere in a database that's still being used by a campaign today. And then the big innovation 10, 12 years ago was people realized that they could buy all of this data that's accumulated by commercial marketers and consumer researchers about your buying habits, things that are used to develop your credit ratings, to tell mail order catalogs so they can decide who they send what to, that's used by charities that are soliciting for contributions, things that come from the warranty forms you fill out, for example. All of that information could be matched to your voter record now. And so the databases could be merged. And now there are hundreds, and probably for most voters, thousands of individual data points that campaigns have access to that they can use to build to run algorithms that they think can help them predict what you're going
to
do.
I'm wondering, as you were speaking, you know, when you go to the grocery store and you use your little club member thing, so they know exactly what I'm buying every week. And I'm sure that somebody could probably predict what my political opinions are based on some of the stuff I buy. You know, I'm thinking if I emerge to be a vegan, which I'm not, then I may very well be an Obama voter. Is that the level to where we're going?
It could be. I mean, so a lot of these consumer variables are things that campaigns have access to. Mm-hmm. They're not always helpful for predicting politics. So, you can get a fair bit of information about what cars people own.
Mm-hmm.
And so, great. I know that Jaguars are likely to be owned by Republicans. Okay. Well, I also can probably just look at the neighborhood you live in and realize that if you're in a wealthy, upscale suburb, the type of place where people own Jaguars, you're also likely to be a Republican. A lot of them are not really shortcuts. You know, the ones that are useful are things that help predict attributes that are not perceivable. And still, the best way of predicting how anybody is going to vote this fall is what party are you registered with, or what do you vote in primaries for a certain party. That still, you know, probably tells you 80% of the likelihood that somebody's going to vote for Obama or Romney is just knowing which party they're attached to.
Let's take a phone call. We have Peter joining us from Princeton. Hi, Peter. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, I can barely hear you.
Go ahead. I can hear you.
Okay, I can hear you now. I'm calling because while your guest comment in the response to a question you posed to him is certainly correct, that the tools are the psychological tools used today, I think he said in the last 5 years, are perhaps in some respect new. I wanted to remind people that the history of psychology as a modern discipline from the 19th century forward actually is closely intertwined with political and ethical topics and projects. So it is inaccurate to say that the link between psychology and politics is something of the last 5 years. Social psychology emerges at the end of the 19th century in America, and it's linked, for example, to polling and intelligence testing from very early on, and these things are used both for political and commercial purposes. And just to mention one other step in this long-term history, after the Second World War, the study of propaganda, particularly by people escaped from Nazi Germany in the United States, centered around exactly the sorts of questions of control, but did it from an academic, social, psychological perspective.
All right, Peter, sorry, yeah. I hate to interrupt you, but your line is breaking up a little bit. But thank you so much for your call, Peter, and I'm going to give Sasha a chance to respond here.
Yeah, no, I obviously the academic disciplines have been connected, and Peter's right to say that psychologists sort of informed a lot of the early sort of election studies and political science. That the behavioral psychologists being involved, running experiments, looking at how to apply behavioral science interventions to change people's behaviors in campaigns is something that is relatively new, and is ultimately still just a small group of people who are cross-pollinating. I mean, one of the major limitations of academic research in campaigns, and this is true for political scientists, it's true for psychologists, is when people are using nonprofit dollars from their school, they can't really play in politics. And so it's made it very difficult for academics to do, you know, the types of research in campaigns that they might want to do in other aspects of human life. And so one of the stories I tell is how people sort of created structures where they can do academic-style research in campaigns through some – there's a secret society called the Analyst Institute that basically exists solely to facilitate that.
And Sasha, we're coming up on a break, but you also write in the book and elsewhere about how journalists are picking up or not on everything that's happening behind the scenes. So you recently in a New York Times article wrote that a lot of political journalists are falling down on the job and are not writing about everything that's happening to win elections.
Yeah, I think we've missed the story for the last decade. And I think part of it is we've fallen down on the job, and part of it is that so much of campaigns is just way too sophisticated or opaque for us to do. I mean, even if we all were really hardworking and diligent at trying to figure this stuff out, there's just a lot of stuff that campaigns do that we can't understand at a technical level, and all sorts of data and research that they're accumulating that we have no access to.
So what do we instead talk about?
I think we should just be generally more comfortable with the uncertainty in campaigns. There's a lot that nobody knows about campaigns. We know very little about how people make up their minds. We know very little about how they choose between candidates. And I think if you watch cable or read political blogs all day, you might think otherwise. I think that there's a whole lot of certainty that goes around from political reporters because they're afraid to acknowledge that there are things that can remain mysterious. There are not as many sort of laws of physics that apply in campaigns that we've demonstrated as I think cable TV might lead you to believe.
How did you get to a lot of the information that you write about in the book? How did you come across it? How did you really delve into it?
You know, I spent the better part of a year, grew up a magazine story I did for the New York Times Magazine about the sort of experimental revolution in campaigns and how it's being informed by behavioral psychology. And I was able to spend a lot of time with people in campaigns who tend not to talk to the media. I think part of it is because other political journalists don't know that they or their job descriptions exist. And part of it is that a lot of them are pretty cautious about, you know, people who do political data are concerned that that they're going to be depicted as sort of invasive of voters' privacy. And people who run these experiments, especially informed by psychology, are afraid that they're going to be depicted as trying to play with people's minds or control them or whatever. And so working on a book where I was able to go back to people and over again and build their trust and show that I wasn't going to take something and tweet it out of context 5 minutes later, and that I wanted to put this in a real context that showed what I think is a real fundamental transformation in how campaigns operate and how they think about what they're doing every day, I think allowed me to win, you know, some trust and confidence from people who many of whom I know have like never spoken to a reporter before.
And we're coming up on a break here, but I want to talk about what voters think of all of this when they in fact learn about it, because it does feel on many levels like we're being manipulated in ways that we don't even know about. We're speaking with Sasha Eisenberg. He is a journalist and author. His new book is The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. And coming up, Sasha, I want to talk a bit about these micro-targeted letters that people have been getting in their inbox. If you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, that's 1-888-477-9499. And we'll be right back here on Radio Times with more.
Virtua and the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia's pediatric partnership is committed to providing quality care for children in South Jersey. CHOP at Virtua offers a child-friendly environment in Virtua's emergency rooms and children's inpatient units in Voorhees and Mount Holly, featuring pediatric specialists and advanced technology. And now open, CHOP at Virtua's Pediatric Specialty Center and Sleep Care Center in Voorhees. More information online at virtua.org. Virtua is a proud supporter of WHYY. on the next Fresh Air, a behind-the-scenes look at President Obama. We talk with Michael Lewis about his article Obama's Way in Vanity Fair. Lewis was given an unusual amount of access to the president, traveling with him, interviewing him, even playing a game of basketball with him. Lewis is the author of Moneyball, Liar's Poker, and The Big Short. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll look back at the Station nightclub fire in Rhode Island that happened 9 years ago. One lawyer says the club was built to burn. Also, the new film Arbitrage tells the story of a successful hedge fund manager who put his life and career in jeopardy by a series of morally questionable decisions. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mike and Scott, in for Marty Moskowain, and we're talking with journalist and author Sasha Eisenberg about his new book, The Victory Lab, with a B, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns, in which he talks about all the things that are happening behind the scenes, the data crunching, the information, the tests, the almost clinical trials that are happening to figure out who votes, why, and how more people can show up at the polls. And Sasha, one thing that I'm sure most people have noticed is these kind of micro-targeted letters that are coming into their inboxes asking them to either give money or to vote, and they seem so personal in nature. I mean, it's like they are talking to me, literally.
Yeah, so I think there are two things going on here. One is that the Obama campaign, basically since 2004, people have been testing what they call A-B tests online for email and for web page design. And it basically means that they often will send a split sample of different messages. So maybe they'll send half of a group a message from Barack Obama and half of a group the same message from Michelle Obama, or they'll change some other variable. They'll send half the group a message from Barack Obama that says hello and half that says hey or whatever. And because it's fundraising, it's very easy to figure out which one made the most money because they can just follow the links through. And so there's this constant cycle of testing and refining messages that happens. And the Obama campaign's incredibly advanced at it. And they also have some very creative writers. And so when those two things come together, it means that they're sort of the equivalent of throwing a lot of things at the wall. The wall just happens to be your inbox.
And I want to listen to something. This was titled Ripped from the Inbox, Real Lines from the Real Obama Emails. And these are dramatic readings of Obama campaign fundraising emails. And they come from the American Conversation and Comedy Central's Indecision 2012. Let's take a listen.
Well, I got some good news and some bad news.
Folks, here's the simple reality.
This is potentially devastating.
Someone is about to tap you on the shoulder.
Don't break into that minibar.
Excuse me.
You know what's kind of amazing?
This will be blunt. This isn't hyperbole or exaggeration.
You'd be crazy not to at least give this a shot.
Cat's out of the bag.
Trust me, you'll have fun.
We could lose. If this continues,
let's fight like hell and win this thing!
Warning. This picture is cute.
Bravo. That is seriously impressive.
Is this your phone?
Want to have a cup of coffee sometime soon?
It doesn't need to be this way!
It's been a long, long week.
Good week.
Just a few hours left till bedtime.
Should be fun.
Yep. Me again.
Hey, have you ever gotten to do something so cool you're almost jealous of yourself?
Karl Rove tweeted about you.
Forget about New Hampshire for a minute.
Seriously, do I need to keep going?
More to come.
And Sasha, I guess what this brings to mind, I did hear from a lot of people who were complaining that they were getting too many emails. So at what point, how do you walk that balance of, you know, nudging and urging but not getting people to tune out.
Yeah, I think that campaigns think differently about appealing to people for money than they do voters. You know, so a lot of the voters you're trying to either persuade or mobilize, there's the potential for a backlash effect, especially for persuasion. People who are not entirely sold on a candidate, I think you're afraid of antagonizing them, which is one reason that bullying them, threatening to shame them, isn't that popular with campaigns. People who've signed up for your fundraising list, so everybody who gets those emails has given their address to the Obama campaign. It's it was over 13 million at the end of 2008. I don't think they've released a number since then, but I assume we have to assume it's closing in on 20 million names that they have. These are all people who've signed up. They're all people who the campaign believes are going to vote for Barack Obama, are supporters. And so I think that they think that there's only upside in hitting them up for money and trying different ways of doing that they're not going to lose a vote at the end of it. So they might, that there's nothing really to be lost.
And is the same kind of scientific research being applied to actual TV ads? Do we know whether people have to like an ad, to respond to it? What do we know about all that?
We ultimately know very little about ads. I mean, one of the things that we ultimately know very little about persuasion. And so one of the things that's really interesting that the campaign in Chicago is doing this year is merging the sort of experiment, these randomized experiments we've talked about, with all this data that they have about individuals, and randomly assigning persuasion messages through advertising, and then polling before and after to measure whether it actually moved people. And what that allows you to do is to sort of get out of the artificial construct of a focus group or polling. You know, in focus groups, you sit people around and you talk a little bit about politics, and you show them an ad, and then you go around and say, so what do you think of Mitt Romney now? And that's not really the way people watch TV ads at home. Like, you may pay attention, you may not. You definitely don't watch it with a bunch of strangers, and nobody's prompting you immediately afterwards to say whether your entire political worldview has been changed. And yet that's basically how campaigns test their ads. And polls have questions like, if you were to learn that Mitt Romney, would it make you more or less likely to vote for Mitt Romney if you knew that as executive of Bain, he had outsourced millions of jobs? That's a weird question to ask somebody.
We haven't really talked about how does social media come into play here. How are campaigns using that to get their message out and also to data mine?
Yeah, I mean, so ultimately, there are very targeted web ads because cookies can follow you across networks and sort of place ads either in video or display ads next to the stuff you're watching. And there's pretty good geographical targeting where people have matched up IP zones with political information about precincts or the census. The sort of the world of Facebook is a place where campaigns want to communicate, but they're sort of limited in how sophisticated they can be because Facebook wants to be the guardian of your information. And so you can buy ads that targeted people geographically. You could buy ads that target people by their likes. But the thing, if you're targeting people who already like a candidate, is it's sort of a limited medium to persuade undecideds or supporters of another candidate. It might be a good place to look for volunteers. It might be a good place to look for donors. But there are sort of limitations that people have to already have taken an action to support a candidate, which means that, the types of, when we talk about campaigns trying to reach undecided voters, you're not going to find them on, already having signed up to like Mitt Romney's page.
I want to listen to something else. This is something I came across on Facebook. This is a campaign tool called Social Organizing developed by NGP Venn. So let's take a listen to their advertisement, which is playing online.
Unfortunately, although it's obvious that friends respond better to friends, there hasn't been a way for campaigns to use those friendships in a targeted way. That's why we created Social Organizing. Social Organizing is the only social media application that seamlessly connects Facebook, the most widely used social network, to the VAN, the most widely used voter and membership database for Democrats and progressives. When supporters log on to a campaign website using their Facebook credentials, Social Organizing helps them match their Facebook friends to voters in the VAN. For example, let's say you're running a campaign in Colorado. When supporters log on through the campaign's website, Social Organizing will help them find friends who live in Colorado and are registered voters. It also asks them how they know each voter.
And Sasha, I will say that I was decidedly freaked out by it, but I have no idea what it does or how it works,
right,
even after watching it four times.
It's basically the digital version of if you had a bunch of volunteers come into a phone bank and gave them a list of all the people you wanted to call because these are the people you wanted to get out the vote on, or these are the people that you wanted to call about a certain issue, and you ask the volunteers, hey, can you look through this list and see if you know any of these people, if they're your colleagues or your friends or your neighbors or your relatives, and they manually went down a clipboard full of names and said, yeah, I know Jimmy, I know Jane. This is basically using Facebook. And so what the VAN, Voter Activation Network, as that ad said, is basically the platform that canvassers and volunteers and phone banks on the Democratic side use to find voters. And what it does is it takes the names off of voter registration database and matches them up against the names and cities that people have in their Facebook profiles. And it'll give you a list of, you know, the example they had was Colorado. Here are 12 people that we think, who are your friends that we think match up with these. Sometimes it'll ask you, is this the same person? And it'll tell you the age that they have on the voter registration file, so that if it's a common name in Denver, that you see whether it's your friend. And then that allows the platform allows you to send a personalized message to them about the issue. And so what it's doing, two things. It's, you know, getting the benefit of rich person-to-person contact with people with whom you have a relationship, which, as best we know from the experiments that have been done, meaningful personal interactions are much better than either ones done by paid callers at call centers or that are being done by sort of impersonal media. But it also allows the campaign through the VAN to segment the people that they want to talk to. So the campaign can say, here are, you know, we're going to take 1 million people that we want to talk to about abortion. Now find your friends and talk to them about abortion. And so the campaign still sort of gets to be the gatekeeper of the types of communication that are taking place, but is able to leverage the sort of human intelligence of their supporters.
So it's like a Tupperware party on some level.
On some level. It's an abortion Tupperware party, yeah.
Oh, boy. All right. So Sasha, I wanted to ask you, you know, where is it all of this going? What is the future of this? I'm thinking, how much more scientific is all of this going to get? Are we going to have ads with subliminal messages that micro-target certain areas of our brain? Who knows? What's going
to
happen?
I mean, there are people who are – there are some neuroscientists who have been trying to test ads, seeing which part of the brain responds
for commercial. Yeah.
And they've been doing it a little bit in politics. The Bush campaign in 2004 talked with somebody who did neuroscience brainwave stuff. They ended up not going through on testing their ads that way because in 2004 it was incredibly complicated to – do in a fast enough way that was responsive to the cycle in which you wanted to develop ads. There's a guy actually in Brazil who used some of it for a political campaign in 2010 for governor of a state there. All he did was change the music, apparently, in the background of an ad when he realized that it made people happier, which seems like a big waste of biological sciences. you know, I think that the big thing is that the range and quality of political activity that takes place online will get better, which is until now the internet has been used mostly for fundraising. It's changing this year partially because campaigns know exactly who you are when you're browsing. We've been able to, through cookies mostly, merge what we know about your offline political identity, because ultimately you vote offline. Your underlying political behavior voting takes place in the precinct near where you live. And I don't want to mobilize people to vote if I don't know who they are in the real world. And finally, campaigns have been able to merge this so they can follow you online and they also know who you are. And at that point, I'm not just asking you for money, but I can start to interact with you in a sort of 360-degree way online.
So could anybody win an election without this kind of machine? I mean, does anything ever come back to character and who a person is at core and what they stand for?
Yeah, I mean, one of the sort of main characters in the book, this behavioral psychologist named Todd Rogers, who's been at the vanguard of testing a lot of these psychology theories and campaigns, sort of warns clients and groups that he's working with at the beginning, look, this can't change the underlying dynamics of a race, right? A good candidate, a bad candidate, a good economy, a bad economy, if your party's popular or not. I mean, all these things set up the sort of opinion architecture of a race. But experiments can find places where you get 2 or 3 or 4% better at mobilizing your supporters. And this micro-targeting can find, 5 or 10 or 15% efficiencies. You know, can we just take the people that already support us and not send them more mail? And can we find the people who are never going to support us and not send them more mail? And maybe all that does is it makes you save 20% off of your mail budget. But if you're spending, you know, $800 million like these two campaigns are this year, that's real money. And so I think we need to think of these things as all marginal improvements. But it's when you look at the polls in a race like this, presidential campaign, it's pretty easy to see why marginal improvements mean a lot to people who are making decisions inside campaigns.
But ultimately, you don't think it's changing what we are as a country, what we stand for in our political process?
I do, and I actually think ultimately for the better, which is, you know, I think we've often talked about the last decade in politics and looked at campaigns like Howard Dean's and George W. Bush's reelection and Obama's that have had this outpouring of volunteers. And we usually talk about it from the sort of like volunteers' perspective. Like, there's a charismatic candidate, everybody loves him, they're so idealistic, and they come out and give their time. And there's some truth to that in each of those instances. But on the other side, campaigns, because they have these experiments that have measured the value of having a volunteer talk to another voter at their doorstep, and people have tested and realized that what they call chatty scripts, which is not just me reading a script verbatim, but me having an actual sort of unstructured conversation that sounds like two human beings talking, is even better than a more formal thing. So the whole body of knowledge is pointing to the idea that human interactions are more have more impact, measurable impact. And so the campaigns have invested in stuff like field offices and staff and training because they have the data and the knowledge to know that this is how they win votes. And it's what we've seen in the last decade fundamentally is that the unit of politics has changed, where the precinct or the county or the large demographic group was the way that campaigns thought about sort of units of political communication. Now they think about the individual, and I'm generally heartened by that.
And Sasha, we're coming up toward the end of the hour here, but nobody likes to be manipulated. As voters, we don't want to see that happen to us. So how do we peek behind the curtain? What's your advice? I noticed on your blog you're starting to explain different terms such as bracketing and so on. How do we recognize these tactics and then have a better sense of what is happening and how we're being approached?
I would just listen closely to – I think we often are sort of absent-minded if a canvasser comes to the door and starts asking a few questions or calls during dinner. Increasingly, there's a real science behind why they ask the questions they ask, what data they're taking from you. More or less anything you say to a caller or somebody who knocks on your door is going into a database somewhere that's being stored. A lot of it's pretty innocuous. If you tell a canvasser you care about the environment, you know, be aware that in 10 years another canvasser comes to your door, will somewhere in the recesses of the data that sent you to their door will be the fact that in 2012 you told somebody that you care about the environment.
Should I ask them? Why are you asking me that?
Often the volunteers don't know. The volunteers don't know a lot more than the journalists do, which is probably a problem for the journalists.
And quickly, in 20 seconds or less, what is bracketing, since I mentioned it?
Bracketing is a silly term that started with Republicans trying to schedule an event before and after a Democratic candidate was in a city, and now it's a way that campaign operatives make things that they do that are unsophisticated sound like they're science.
All right, Sasha Eisenberg, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sasha is a journalist and author, and his new book is The Victory Lab, The Secret Science of Winning Campaigns. And thank you also for your phone calls. You've been listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.